Thank you, Marcia, and thank you for coming today. And we are going to depart from the school now and actually start looking around the school. I'm going to give you a quick background about the issue, provide some context about CX3, and present them some data, some descriptive data findings. We have some additional contributors, Valerie Quinn and Sharon Sugarman, who work with me at the network as well. And of course, I have no financial disclosures. So to give you a little bit of background to what we've been building on in terms of evidence of the relationships of fast food and the proximity to schools, Davis et al. Really found that there's a link to fast food within a half mile of schools with a higher BMI and poor dietary behaviors. Simon also took a look at that in terms of disparities between schools. And then Austin and Quate, they looked at it in terms of using spatial analysis and did sort of more of a GIS approach. I also want to add that recently Reedy et al. Came out with some findings using NHANES data that shows that nearly 40% of calories consumed by children and youth are in the form of empty calories. So this slide is showing some results from California, our survey CalTeens at the Network for Healthy California. And CalTeen stands for California Teen Eating, Exercise, and Nutrition Survey. And we're actually seeing some good news here. We're seeing some positive trends. We're down to about the year 2000 levels. So that's very exciting. We've been pleased to see that drop going on. This survey looks at surveys about 1,200 youth, 12 to 17 years old, and it's self-reported data. However, when we look at some other sources, we do see among CalTeens and CHIS, which is the California Health Interview Survey, it's a much larger sample than what we have. And then we also look at YRBSS, which is the national sample, and then NHANES. With the self-reported samples, we see the drop coming down a little bit, but with NHANES, which is actually collected heights and weights, we're not seeing that change yet. So to look at some data from fast food and soda consumption among this population, from our survey at CalTeens, we find that 23% of youth this age reported eating at least once on the previous day for fast food. And with CHIS, which again is the California Health Interview Survey, 46% of youth report eating fast food two or more times per week, and 13% report four or more times each week. Nearly 9% reported eating fast food two or more times on a previous day. That's a lot. So they're really in the fast food outlets. And 26% drank two or more sugar-sweetened beverages per day. But the good news is it's down from 31%, which was 2005 versus 2007 for CHIS. 60 to 62% drank one or more sugar-sweetened beverage a day. So I'd like to provide a little background from our fast food industry perspective. This came as a quote that came from Ray Kroc, a McDonald's Corporation founder, and I pulled this also from the report that's Let's Retire Ronald, which you might have heard with Michelle Simon's presentation in the earlier session. And it says, back in the days when we first got a company airplane, we used to spot good locations for McDonald's stores by flying over a community and looking for schools. Now we use a helicopter, and it's ideal. So you know they're targeting them. And to provide a little bit of an international perspective, recently England allowed a ban for fast food around schools. And this is done using the councils or authorities in the planning application process. And they've allowed these locations and these counties basically to consider health and well-being of children and banning these fast food outlets around the schools. Some of them have reported using a 400-meter exclusion zone, which is about two blocks or a quarter mile. And this article reported cited a study that found that their secondary schools have on average 23 junk food outlets in their neighborhoods, with some surrounded by 46, which is a lot. So to move on to some context of our project, Communities of Excellence, at the Network for Healthy California. CX3 is based on a tobacco prevention project that is in the tobacco control program in the California Department of Public Health. But we took that and we put the spin on it of nutrition, physical activity, and obesity prevention. So basically, it's documenting the physical environment and encouraging local action to change behaviors, to change conditions that support healthy individual behaviors. And it involves assessing communities in relation to a variety of obesity prevention benchmarks that we've developed, known as community indicators and assets. And from there, we develop tools and methods from those indicators of healthy communities to take a look at whether or not the communities were meeting those indicators. And it activates the consumers and partners to actually improve the food availability in the low-income neighborhoods. So this also gives you a little context of the whole overall program of CX3. We look at access to supermarkets, we look at the density of fast food in the neighborhood, and then also we look at around the schools. We look at small markets and convenience stores around schools and farmers markets, and we do all this first stage through a mapping process using GIS. And our GIS is actually an online map viewer, and it has over 100 data layers in it, and we just use a portion of those. We train the local health departments to interpret the maps through a series of exercises that give them measures that are meaningful and can be shared with their communities or their stakeholders. We also have them go into the community and do field surveys, and this just gives you an idea of what I'm going to present today, which is the fast food components, which is the surveys. But they also do surveys in grocery stores and small markets, and they take a look at outdoor marketing around schools. Another component to CX3 is an assessment and tracking process where they look at alternative food sources, emergency food outlets, local health department infrastructure, and media coverage. So we have 23 Network for Healthy California funded local health departments that have participated in CX3. And there are all kinds of neighborhoods that have been doing this, urban, dense, suburban, rural, remote. But we've also trained some health departments and projects outside of the Network for Healthy California. And overall, we've actually trained more than half the health departments in California. So when they do CX3, they need to select a neighborhood, actually 3 to 7 low-income neighborhoods. And to do that, they have to use the census tracts as their boundaries. And more than 50% of the population in the census tracts need to be at or below 185% of the federal poverty level. And then they have other selection factors, and one of those is having a school in the neighborhood. So how we define fast food outlets is we look at fast food chains and non-chains, pizza and sandwich or deli. And those are quick service restaurants that have to be where it's minimal service and the food's ready quickly after they're ordered. It's ordered and purchased prior to consumption at a counter. So we look at the number of outlets of this type, of these different types, within 1,000 feet and a half mile to schools in the neighborhood. And we look at the proportion of the schools with fast food outlets within the 1,000 feet, which is about 2 blocks and a half mile. And then we look at the highest number of outlets for the school with fast food within 1,000 feet and a half mile. So basically, what's the worst case scenario? So they can target their schools better. This is an image to give you just a visual of kind of what the mapping looks like. So in the center, you'll see a little blue box on top of the flag, and that's the school. And then we have them draw a half-mile buffer or radius around the school, and then the GIS gives them the red boxes inside the circle, which are the fast food outlets. So some of our findings from the mapping process, and this is looking at all the neighborhoods. So around the schools, within 1,000 feet, about half of them didn't have any fast food, but 30% had about one or two. And then if you expand that out to a half mile, there were only 11% that didn't have any, and 22% had 10 or more. And there was a mean of 6 within a half mile. So, but we also decided to pull from the surveys that the local health departments did, and these are collected by whatever the local health departments decide to use as their collection surveyors. And some of them use local health department staff, some of them use community members or youth, and we train them in quality control methods, and then we do the data input up at the state level, and we have a quality control process as well to minimize missing data and those kinds of things. The surveys that we pulled are all surveys that are all of the fast food around the schools. So you're just going to see from the data that I'm going to present, it's just the fast food that are around the school. So we're not going to show you any of the school data that doesn't have fast food. So these surveys are from 2008 and 2009. And it's in 31 neighborhoods. They're usually about 1 to 2 census tracts. We had 44 schools within a half mile. And the sample of these schools are 34% elementary, 21 middle, and 43% high school with a few that are continuation high schools. There were 233 fast food outlets in the sample, and 27% were within 1,000 feet of the school, and 27% were within 1,000 feet, and 23% were visible from the school. So looking at the schools as a sample, there was the mean of fast food around the schools, and the worst case scenario was 22 fast food outlets within a half mile. So not quite as bad as the report from England, which was 46 fast food outlets, but pretty bad. But then if we look at the fast food as the sample, the school type is the majority of these are around high schools. The types of fast food that are around these schools are mostly these non-chain restaurants. So these non-chains are actually probably not going to need to comply with the menu labeling that we're going to see implemented. But there's also a fair amount of fast food chains. So this shows the number and type of ads on the doors and windows that we collected. And what we did is we collapsed the small, medium, and large unhealthy ads and healthy ads. And you can see that there's a lot that don't have any healthy ads. And there's about actually 62% of the outlets that had a lot or many were all fast food chains. So we're seeing most of the marketing in fast food chains. When we look at the large unhealthy ads, 33% of these had these large unhealthy ads. But they're not just on the doors and windows. 27% of them had ads on the roof or the walls, and 28% had ads elsewhere on the property. So like fences, garbage cans, telephone booths, those kinds of things. I mean, some of these are just plastered. So we also look at child-oriented marketing. And 31% of the fast food that we took a look at had toys and kids meals. But among those fast food that had toys and kids meals, 84% of them are the fast food chains. Now, I know probably some of you have heard about Santa Clara County that has banned toys and kids meals, and that San Francisco just, this board of supervisors approved it, but we don't know what's going to happen with the mayor, if he's going to veto it or what. So we'll see what happens with that. But this is something that is looked at as a business practice, and it is a new way for us to kind of stop that targeting. So 15% of the fast food ads that were kid-oriented ads that were on the doors and windows. So looking at the nutrition information and labeling, this was in 2008 and 2009, and we kind of expected to see a little bit of some of these outlets putting things on the menu board, because in 2009 is when the California menu labeling went into process. So, but we didn't see any, and we don't know if we're going to see any for a while. So it depends on what's going to happen with the national law, and there's a lot to be determined with that because we don't have the regs yet. So once the regs come out, we'll see what happens with that. But actually, it says that FDA can add other things to be required, not just calories on the menu board. So keep that in mind, and please advocate for other things to be included in that. But you can see that most of these outlets are doing this brochure or pamphlet that's shows the nutrition and information. And not a lot are doing the poster, but it's mostly the brochure. So the brochures and the information that we collected had to be within 6 feet of the counter for it to count. And this gives you an image of what you might see, and this is what's required by California law. And it has to have, for us, it had to have total calories, carbohydrates, saturated fat, and sodium. So you'll see probably more of this, but not a lot of people are probably going to pull that out with their magnifying glass. But this is what we also see. And this is the brochures or the posters are often not near that point of purchase. They're back at the bathroom. So, and you see in this picture that the display is actually empty. So there are no pamphlets or brochures for them to take. So the implications of this is more evidence for documenting the presence of fast food around schools. And it shows the importance for developing meaningful targeted nutrition education for students around schools because of what they're exposed to. It's really critical to understand what kids are up against, not only in the walls of the school, but outside. It can inform partnerships and policies and show the need for initiatives to reduce fast food and marketing of fast food around schools. So last slide. What we're going to do next with CX3 we've got under development is we're developing a school score that looks at the environment within a half-mile boundary. And we're going to look at a lot of different things within that half-mile boundary, the retail food stores, fast food, outdoor marketing, and we're actually going to pilot some mobile vending tools based on work done by Gene Tester, and walkability and safety. And we're going to put that into a school score. We're also looking at a food exposure scale that's going to include all opportunities for eating. So not just fast food and stores and convenience stores and stuff like that, but looking at ice cream, donuts, coffee shops, those specialty stores and things. And we want to examine the relationship of that with body composition using FitnessGram, which is actually data that, that comes from weights that are measured and income and school level. So thank you very much, and this is my contact information.
So if the panelists will come up to the chair. And do we have any questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, this question actually is directed to Barbara, Michelle, and Alyssa. Have you given consideration to any type of educational program for the teens and kids? That way they can learn how this marketing essentially takes advantage of them, but also reinforces all the information that you want to put out there. Because nutrition labeling means nothing to them if they don't understand it, nor if they don't see the relationship as to how they're being manipulated.
I can answer that for the fast food piece. The data that's collected for CX3 is fully intended for them to use as targeting for their nutrition education. So they look at the schools, the health departments look at the schools to see which one is in the greatest need for this nutrition education. And then they can target that school for these types of initiatives that need to happen to actually educate the students. It gives them a much better way to determine which schools are the most important to target.
Yeah, and actually we haven't talked about coming up with specific educational materials based on our research, just came out, but we have looked at the issue of media literacy, which is kind of what you're talking about, and I'm not a huge fan myself of using that as the only approach to, educating or eliminating behaviors based on marketing, just because, even as adults, I think we have trouble basing our decisions on knowledge and understanding of those messages, and I'm not sure that younger people have that ability.
In the back.
How did you recruit your wellness champions, and who were they within the school? Were they the counselor, the teachers?
So we really used the RFP process as a way to form each of the schools' program. And so within the RFP, we required that the RFP identify the wellness champions for their campus and show us how that wellness champion was the right person to be the champion. They needed to be somebody who had established relationships at the school with both the students as well as other teachers and the administration. They needed to be in a position where they were able to influence others in the school. And so sites that proposed a wellness champion who maybe was to be decided or was someone who seemed sort of tangential to the school, those sites did not get funded.
Yes.
These programs, in terms of we talk about educating kids, but what about dealing with the double standard that most of the violations, or a lot of them you saw, were the teachers? And I can remember years ago when my son was in elementary school and I was a PTO president, and we were there one evening working for something, and I had to go in the teacher's lounge, and oh my God, you should have seen his eyes when he saw the pop machine and the candies. And Mom, how come they have this? And we're not allowed to have this, and we teach them that. So again, you know, you're looking at these schools that have a lot of the fast food restaurants, but clearly we have a serious issue with the double standards of the adults who are clearly showing children and are using these products and so forth. And it's not going to work if we don't target them also in these education programs.
I agree.
Yes. I have a question for Lisa. Are you guys also including the parents in the involvement for wellness teams, or just that down?
So on the wellness committees, parents are included. And in fact, at one of the schools, there's two folks sharing the wellness champion role, and one of them is the official parent coordinator at the school, so she has very close ties to the parents. At the high schools, although there are parents on the wellness committees, I'd say the focus is much stronger on the youth engagement than the parent engagement.
How do you involve the parents?
So the parents are involved in work on the wellness committees, and then there are various events and particular strategies that the parents are involved in. So for instance, at one of the middle schools, parents are involved through this parent coordinator in serving a fresh fruit break to the kids every morning of the school. So the parents get donations of fruit, they come in and actually prepare the fruit and then give it out to the kids. And the parents are active in thinking about how the cafeteria can be changed, and they want to start volunteering to do a fresh vegetable juice bar within the cafeteria. So that school, the parents are very, very engaged. I'd say at our other middle school, the parents, the entire community around that school, unfortunately, is very challenged. A lot of dysfunction among the families, and those parents are a lot less engaged. There are one or two on the wellness committee.
We have time for just a few more questions. I think I've been stalling here, so let's go to you.
For the study looking at school meals, did you look at whether or not the food services was outsourced, either part of all of it was outsourced, either to a food service management company, or they focused on prepared meals?
No, we didn't. That's probably something I should go back and look at as we do more analysis of this data. That's a very good point.
Really fascinated by the whole school wellness program, and I'm from Philadelphia Network of Food Trust. And through the Recovery Act money, the CDC has given the entire school district of Philadelphia the money to implement exactly what you're doing. But we're starting with the entire school district. So we're starting with 200 schools versus 5, and the amount of money that we can spread amongst the schools is very different. And my question, so for our wellness champs, their stipend's $100. What was your stipend for your wellness champ?
So there's actually a little bit of variation because some of the wellness champions are teachers and others are the school-based health center employees. But, and I can't remember the exact figures, but it's a couple $1,000.
More than us.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the issue with that. You know, you really want the stipend to give them release time from their other job duties. to focus on this at $100. It's more like an incentive.
Yeah, it is. And our other problem, too, that we're in the process of signing on our schools, you know, getting them to buy in and participate. You said $50,000 was given to each school apart. Yeah, so ours is the process is a mini grant that they could apply for during the winter of a couple months. So mm-hmm. It's just really interesting to compare, you know, the ability that money can make, you
right.
know, the power money has.
Right.
Things happen in schools.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but if you have further questions, maybe our panel can stay just for a few moments longer to answer your questions. Thank you so much.